From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a series of unfortunate events. The popular children's book series by Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, is the basis of a new film. The stories follow the orphan Baudelaire children who face misfortune and are pursued by an evil count. Also, we listen back to an interview with the late Mario Puzo. The characters who created in the Godfather novel are now the basis of a new novel, The Godfather Returns, by Mark Weingartner. And film critic David Edelstein reviews A Very Long Engagement and House of Flying Daggers. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is close to completing his second-term cabinet today, nominating Samuel Bodman as Energy Secretary, NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president continued his pattern of nominating loyalists to the cabinet. Bodman is already a member of the administration, serving as Deputy Secretary of the Treasury. Prior to that, he was Deputy Commerce Secretary. In a brief ceremony to announce his nomination, the president called Bodman a problem solver.
He will bring to the Department of Energy a great talent for management and the precise thinking of an engineer. I thank him for agreeing to serve once again.
In his second term, the president plans a renewed push for an energy bill in Congress, including drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. Mr. Bush has one more cabinet vacancy to fill, Secretary of Health and Human Services. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the White House.
Attorney General John Ashcroft said goodbye to staffers at the Justice Department today. He praised what he called their sacrifice and courage and said it was a main reason that terrorists have not struck again inside the United States. Ashcroft defended the Bush administration against critics who say civil liberties have been reduced under the Patriot Act and other policies imposed after 9/11.
Some said that freedom was the price we would pay for our security, but here we are, 3 years later, a freer nation than before.
Ashcroft said that over the past 3 years, 375 people have been charged in terror-related cases and 190 have pleaded guilty or been convicted. Ashcroft will stay on the job until his successor, White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, is confirmed by the Senate. Chief Justice William Rehnquist still plans to administer the oath of office at President Bush's inauguration on January 20th. Rehnquist has been missing from the Supreme Court bench for weeks while he undergoes cancer treatment. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Since the announcement of Rehnquist's thyroid cancer, there's been widespread speculation that he would step down. The treatment, a tracheotomy plus chemotherapy and radiation, was an indication that the 80-year-old Chief Justice is suffering from an extremely serious and severe form of cancer. Rehnquist's absence from the court for the last 6 weeks has led to speculation that he would be too ill to administer the presidential oath of office in January. But today, the court spokeswoman said that Rehnquist has accepted the invitation to administer the oath on January 20th. Rehnquist has continued to work at home during his illness, participating in the decision of cases based on briefs and transcripts of oral arguments. His absence from the bench, however, has fueled rumors of an imminent retirement, rumors that may abate now, at least temporarily. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 9 to close at 10,543 in active trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index was down a fraction to 2128. This is NPR News. Daimler Chrysler has agreed to recall 600,000 Dodge SUVs and pickup trucks because of a defect that can cause their wheels to fall off. The recall affects Durango SUVs and Dakota pickup trucks from the 2000 to 2003 model years. A company spokesman said Chrysler was following a government recommendation, although it didn't believe a safety recall was warranted. The world's largest air carrier has once again raised fares. American Airlines blames high fuel costs for the boost in all domestic fares and the cost of trips between the United States and Canada. Bill Zeeble reports from KERA in Dallas.
American Airlines has boosted all domestic fares and the cost of trips between the United States and Canada. The hike amounts to $5 each way. American says the increase will help offset the ongoing high jet fuel costs. Currently, that rate's about $1.10 a gallon. So for this fourth quarter, American figures it'll pay almost $500 million more for fuel than it did a year ago. The company said that for every 1 cent rise in the price of jet fuel, its costs go up $30 million a year. In its most recent quarter, when it reported a profit loss, American said it would have earned a profit if not for the soaring fuel prices. For NPR News, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
A bomb killed at least 11 people today in a crowded market in the Pakistani city of Quetta. Police say at least 24 people were wounded by the bomb, which was apparently set off by a timer. The bomb was hidden on a bicycle that was parked next to an army truck. The dead included 1 soldier and 10 civilians. A separatist group claimed responsibility for the blast. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA CREF, providing a wide selection of individual retirement solutions. TIAACREF.org/radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest today is the author of many best-selling mock Victorian novels for children. They tell the tales of 3 unlucky orphans who lead lives filled with misery and woe, as they are constantly on the run from a repulsive and treacherous villain and endure terrible accidents, itchy clothing, and bad singing. These novels are collectively known as A Series of Unfortunate Events. They're written by Lemony Snicket, the pen name of Daniel Handler. Handler's eerie characters are about to hit the big screen, starring Jim Carrey, the same rubbery actor who brought the Grinch to three-dimensional life. In the film being released next week, called Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events, Carrey stars as the evil Count Olaf and also plays many other roles. In this scene, he's accepting delivery of his distant relatives, the 3 Baudelaire children, orphaned after their wealthy parents have perished in a fire.
I will raise these orphans as if they were actually wanted. And though you would call it a burden, a sacrifice, you are mistaken, sir, and should be ashamed of yourself. The idea! Anyway, where do I sign for the fortune? I mean, children.
Oh, you won't officially have guardianship until the hearing on Thursday morning.
And what am I to do with them until then?
Excuse me?
What I mean is, do you work out? You look good, healthy, I mean.
When Terry spoke with Daniel Handler in 2001, they started with a reading from the first Lemony Snicket book, The Bad Beginning, which begins, as Snicket often does, with a warning to his readers.
If you are interested in stories with happy endings, you would be better off reading some other book. In this book, not only is there no happy ending, there is no happy beginning and very few happy things in the middle. This is because not very many happy things happened in the lives of the 3 Baudelaire youngsters. Violet, Klaus, and Sonny Baudelaire were intelligent children, and they were charming and resourceful and had pleasant facial features, but they were extremely unlucky, and most everything that happened to them was rife with misfortune, misery, and despair. I am sorry to tell you this, but that is how the story goes.
A little further into the story, we find out that the Baudelaire's parents just perished in a fire that also destroyed their home. And so their endless misfortunes begin. Now, your book, as we heard, starts with a warning that readers might be better off with a more cheerful book. Why did you decide to start your book that way?
Well, it seemed only fair to warn anyone who was seeking cheerfulness. And also, when I sat down to start writing for children, I really had no bearing in children's literature. I hadn't read a book for children since I was a youngster. And but I remembered this overwhelmingly moralistic tone in all of my least favorite books, so I thought it might be good to sort of mock that from the outset, and warn children away from the story instead of the sort of typical treacly beginning, which is, you know, this is a very charming story and you're just going to love the adorable hero.
What are some of the terrible things that have happened to these orphans?
Oh, well, I mean, it's such a depressing list. I hate to think of drivers listening to NPR driving off the road as I as I list them off, I mean, they meet Count Olaf, who is a distant relative who is only after the fortune that their parents have left behind. He's a terrible person who tries to marry the eldest Baudelaire, Violet, and locks up the baby in a birdcage and dangles it outside of his tower window. They go to stay with their kindly Uncle Monty, who's murdered. They go to stay with their Aunt Josephine, who throws herself out of a window, or at least so it appears. They're forced to work in a lumber mill. They go to school. That's always a terrible thing. They stay with rich people and find themselves falling down an elevator shaft. They're driven out of town by an angry mob with torches and barking dogs. And then in the most recent volume, they find themselves prepared for unnecessary surgery in the hospital. So it's really quite a cornucopia of terrible things.
There's a lot of literary jokes, like little in references that only adult readers would get, or at least teenage readers. You know, like the orphans are named the Baudelaire children. Their first names are Klaus and Sonny, two of them. You want to name some of the other little references?
Well, they're cared for by Mr. Poe. They're at one point they fall into the household of Jerome and Esme Squalor, who are named after J.D. Salinger's story for Esme with Love and Squalor. They attend Prufrock Preparatory School after the poem by T.S. Eliot. Yeah, they're pretty much surrounded by the world of books. I liked the idea of a universe that was governed entirely by books. The Baudelaires find the solutions, or what appear to be the solutions to their problems, in libraries in each volume, and so there's sort of some heavy-handed, or I hope mock heavy-handed, propaganda saying that all of life's difficulties can be solved within the pages of the right book.
Well, another thing you do in your books is you use kind of big words, and then you define them for your readers. Let me read an example. This comes from the last page of your first Lemony Snicket book. And the sentence is, the car drove farther and farther away until Justice Strauss was merely a speck in the darkness. And it seemed to the children that they were moving in an aberrant, the word aberrant here means very, very wrong and causing much grief, into an aberrant direction. Tell me how you developed that approach to taking a big word that may be above the reading level of your readers, and then managing to humorously define it within the sentence.
Well, it wasn't really as artificial as that. I mean, I just like a lot of words, and I wanted to put them in these books. And as I was writing them when I was writing the first book, it would occur to me that maybe aberrant was a word that wasn't known to many third graders, and so then it seemed to fit right into this mock moralizing tone that the narrator would stop often at. Very, very suspenseful moments, and define the word in a way that was hopelessly bound to that individual context, and so it makes me very happy to know that that now, I mean, there's sort of millions of fourth graders who know what the word ersatz means, and that's or know what the expression casing the joint or understand dramatic irony, that really excites me. So I don't sit around pedagogically and think, well, what can I teach the little nippers? But I just love these words, and I just wanted to put them in my books. There are not enough books that have the word corpulent, in my opinion.
Your new novel is set in Heimlich Hospital. Little Heimlich maneuver joke in there.
Well, I think he's such an unheralded medical phenomenon. It would only seem fair to put him in at least one book.
Why a hospital?
Well, hospitals are really terrifying places, I think, for children and for adults. And they're also places that are so often sanitized in children's literature. There's this sense that children ought not to worry when they go into the hospital. And so there are all these books that say, oh, the hospital's really a fun place and everyone there just wants to make you better and you get to watch TV and eat ice cream all day long. And it's really quite a pleasure. And that just seems terrible to me to tell a child that they're not going to have a scary time in the hospital. Of course they're going to have a scary time in the hospital.
Now, there's a group of professionals in your novel whose job it is to cheer up the people in the hospital. And initially the Baudelaire children hide out in their van. And this is how they end up in the hospital. They're hiding out in this van carrying a group called Volunteers Fighting Disease. And this is a band of people who go to the hospitals to cheer up the sick. And they sing this weird, seemingly cheerful song. Would you recite the song that you wrote for them to sing?
Yes, of course. We are volunteers fighting disease, and we're cheerful all day long. If someone said that we were sad, that person would be wrong. We visit people who are sick and try to make them smile, even if their noses bleed or if they cough up bile. And the chorus is, tra-la-la, fiddle-dee-dee, hope you get well soon. Ho-ho-ho, he-he-he, have a heart-shaped balloon. We visit people who are ill and try to make them laugh, even when the doctor says he must saw them in half. We sing and sing all night and day, and then we sing some more. We sing to boys with broken bones and girls whose throats are sore. Tra-la-la, fiddle-dee-dee, hope you get well soon. Ho-ho-ho, he-he-he, have a heart-shaped balloon. We sing to men with measles and to women with the flu, and if you breathe in deadly germs, we'll probably sing to you. Tra-la-la, fiddle-dee-dee, hope you get well soon. Ho-ho-ho, he-he-he, have a heart-shaped balloon.
What do you think of the song? how would you feel if this song were sung to you?
Well, I think I would have that same annoyed feeling that I always feel if I'm surrounded by people who are singing to me in order to cheer me up. I mean, I think every child and adult knows the horror of it, of going to a restaurant and having it turn out to be the sort of restaurant where everybody stands around and sings happy birthday. And it's that same dread that I tried to capture in those lyrics.
I'd like to hear an example of a song that you do like, so I thought I'd ask you to do this. Stephen Merritt, who is with the group Magnetic Fields and is probably best known for his CDs, 69 Love Songs, which is 69 songs in every imaginable genre of love songs, and some of them are straight songs and some of them are parodies of love songs. Anyways, he...
And some of them are decorated with accordion played by myself.
Uh-huh. And you and he are old friends. You wrote the liner notes for his CD, and he's writing a series of songs to accompany the audio versions of your books.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps you can sing unaccompanied one of those songs?
Certainly. This is the song that he composed that I perform when I'm usually in front of an audience of children. And usually I'm accompanying myself on the accordion, but today will be a cappella due to some accordion-related trouble. The Count has an eye on his ankle and lives in a horrible place. He wants all your money, he's never at all funny, he wants to remove your face. And you might be thinking what a romp this is, but wait till you meet his accomplices. When you see Count Olaf, you're suddenly full of disgust and despair and dismay. In the whole of the soul of Count Olaf, there's no love. When you see Count Olaf, count to zero. Then scream and run away. Scream, scream, scream and run away. Run, 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 or die. Die, 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 die.
Very good. I like that. Did you write the lyric?
Thank you. No, that's Mr. Merritt's invention thoroughly.
But based on your character?
Yes.
So I'm glad you get to sing that at your readings. It goes over well, I assume.
Well, yes, we usually encourage everyone's least favorite thing, audience participation. So during the part where I sing run, everyone runs. And then the part where I sing die, everybody slumps over on the floor. And really, you haven't lived until you're standing in an independent bookstore watching a lot of 8 and 9-year-olds slump over as if dead.
Daniel Handler speaking to Terry Gross in 2001. Under the pen name Lemony Snicket, he writes the best-selling children's series, A Series of Unfortunate Events. Jim Carrey stars in the film based on the series, which will open next week. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Daniel Handler, who writes the mock Victorian children's novels, A Series of Unfortunate Events. He uses the pen name Lemony Snicket.
Now, you write your Series of Unfortunate Events novels under the pseudonym of Lemony Snicket. How did you come up with that name?
Well, first off, I should say that I'm not sure pseudonym is exactly right, because the character of Lemony Snicket, this man who speaks directly to the reader and also who is tangentially involved in the stories that he's telling, is really more of a character. We just thought it would be fun to publish the books under the name of this character. But the name Lemony Snicket I actually had lying around before I had any desire to write for children. I was researching the first of two novels that I've published under my own name, the first novel, The Basic Eight, and I needed to contact, for research purposes, some right-wing political organizations and religious groups, and I wanted material mailed to me, but I didn't want to be on their mailing list for obvious reasons, and so someone asked me, so what is your name? And I opened my mouth, and out popped the words Lemony Snicket. And it became, among all of my friends then, a joke. We would write letters to the paper and sign them Lemony Snicket, hoping they would be published, and reserve tables in restaurants under the name Lemony Snicket, and all sorts of things like that. And so for a small, select group of the population, the idea that the name Lemony Snicket has risen to such notoriety is particularly shocking.
Do you have much merchandising involved with your books?
No, really none as yet. We gave away some Band-Aids for the hostile hospital that said unfortunate event on them. I'm pretty proud of those. And we just had some terrible greeting cards just in time for the holidays, which are available at one of the chain bookstores. Greeting cards that say things like, why haven't you called? And it's all downhill from here.
If people start asking you more about merchandising, is there a place where you would insist on drawing the line, something that you... Some kind of typically commercial way of merchandising children's literature that you wouldn't want to be part of?
Well, gosh, it's such a slippery slope. I mean, you know, I always think, well, it would really be horrible to be associated with fast food, but then not too long ago I had a fantasy that, you know, there would be unhappy meals that would come out of a series of unfortunate events. You know, maybe a little mad cow disease in the burger or just whatever we could do to really make them unsavory. No, I don't know. It's very difficult to say. More and more children write to me or come up to me in bookstores and say, in effect, what else is there that I can buy? And it's sort of it's both a frightening question and an understandable one. And I hope that if there is any merchandise, that it will be the sort of merchandise that that encourages people who buy it to really have fun in their imaginations. I mean, on one hand, a movie like Star Wars seems over-merchandised, but it would really be impossible to overemphasize how much fun I had when I was a kid playing with all the Star Wars characters and making up my own stories, and I think becoming a storyteller rose out of that kind of play. So it's very hard to tell. It's so easy to say, oh, well, I shouldn't have any of my literature sullied by commercial attention. But once you begin to actually think of how people would use what other people want to make, it's also hard to say no.
Have you run into any parents, teachers, or librarians who object to either the tone or the content of your books?
Not nearly as many as I thought I would. I really thought that there would just be an overwhelming wave of outrage. And instead, there have just been a few isolated complaints that I've heard. We were banned in one school district in Decatur, Georgia. I'll always have that. They can't take that away from me.
On what grounds were you banned?
Well, I hate to get too catty about Decatur, Georgia, but they were very concerned in the bad beginning that Count Olaf wants to marry Violet, who is a distant relative. And this strikes me as something that, without being too stereotypical about the South, that perhaps Decatur, Georgia has heard of before, let's just say. And also, I'm at a loss for how to construct a villain who isn't doing villainous things. If Count Olaf were only doing things that no one would object to, then he really wouldn't be much of a villain. So I'm somewhat nonplussed by that kind of criticism that, boy, Count Olaf is sure a terrible person. And so I always have to write back and say, well, yes, yes, he is. he sure is. Let's catch him. and a woman once in Oregon came up to me at a bookstore and said, you know, in one of your books, you teach that it is sometimes necessary to lie. And that seems like a very disturbing lesson to me. Can you name one time when it would be absolutely necessary to lie? And I was so happy that the answer came to me right away instead of, you know, as it usually does when people say something to you and then you think 3 days later, oh, that's what I should have said. Instead, it came right away and I was able just to turn to her and say, nice sweater. I'm just really proud of that.
What was her reaction?
I think she said thank you. I'm not sure that the lesson was taught, but at least I was able to sleep at night knowing that I'd been able to say something in response. I mean, of course you have to lie. And I can't imagine that you would want to teach your child never to lie under any circumstances. That's not going to serve the child well when the child goes to a birthday party and is forced to say whether or not he or she had a nice time.
Well, Daniel Handler, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Daniel Handler, speaking to Terry Gross in 2001. Under the pen name Lemony Snicket, he's the author of the children's book series A Series of Unfortunate Events. A film of the same name will be released next week, starring Jim Carrey. Here's something from a collection by One Ring Zero of songs with lyrics written by authors. This is called Radio. Music by One Ring Zero, lyrics by Daniel Handler. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Time you loved me so, I wouldn't have a radio at all. Now I sit and waste my time, my room is quiet as a mime, and wait for someone glamorous to call.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Tree, A New Vision of the American Forest, by photographer James Balog. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Purple Book 2005 Edition, The Definitive Guide to Exceptional Online Shopping, by Hilary Mendelson. And from Starbucks Coffee Company, on behalf of all neighborhood locations, Starbucks is proud to support NPR during the holiday season. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the origin of The Godfather. We listen back to an interview with the late Mario Puzo, who wrote the novel that spawned the Academy Award-winning films. There's a new book, The Godfather Returns, based on his characters. And David Edelstein reviews the films A Very Long Engagement and House of Flying Daggers.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. The first Godfather movie ends with Michael Corleone, played by Al Pacino, wiping out his enemies, the heads of the five rival mob families and traitors in his own family, including Carlo, his brother-in-law. Michael has always suspected that Carlo was complicit in the murder of his older brother, Sonny.
You have to answer for Santino, Carlo.
Mike, you got it all wrong.
You fingered Sonny for the Barzini people. Ah, that little farce you played with my sister. You think that could fool the Corleone?
Mike, I'm innocent. I just run the kids. Please, Mike, don't do this.
Sit down. Barzini's dead. So is Philip Tattaglia. Mo Green. Stracci. Cuneo. Today I settle all family business, so don't tell me you're innocent, Carlo. Admit what you did. Get him a drink. Come on. Don't be afraid, Carlo. Come on. You think I make my sister a widow? I'm godfather to your son, Carlo. Go ahead, drink. No, Carlo, you're out of the family business. That's your punishment. You're finished. I'm putting you on a plane to Vegas. Tom? I want you to stay there. You understand? Uh-huh. Only don't tell me you're innocent. Because it insults my intelligence. It makes me very angry.
Carlo has a very short trip ahead of him, but it's not on a plane, and he never makes it to Vegas. This month, The Godfather Returns. That's the name of a new novel about the Corleone family, based on the characters created by Mario Puzo, who died in 1999. The Godfather Returns was written by Mark Weingartner, who won the job when Random House held a contest to find an author to follow in Puzo's literary footsteps. The new novel fills in some of the gaps in the Corleone family narrative, covering events in years not covered in either the book or the famous Godfather films. In 1996, Terry Gross spoke with Mario Puzo, who wrote The Godfather in 1969. He also co-wrote all The Godfather screenplays. People have always assumed he had some inside connection to the mafia, which he always denied. But Puzo told Terry that many of the stories in The Godfather novel and films came from his family.
You know, like the rug stealing scene and the keeping of the guns from the police, you know, that kind of stuff that happened in the family.
Oh, well, tell the story the way it was told to you.
Well, my brother, who's older than me, this guy threw his guns over the airway, you know, the space between apartments, and my mother took them and held them for him, and then he came and got back his guns, and he said, would you like a rug? So she sent my brother over to get the rug. And my brother didn't realize the guy was stealing the rug until he took out the gun when the cop came. So that's almost entirely in the book and in the movie, you know. And there's little stuff like that.
Now, how did your mother feel about protecting this guy's guns?
Oh, in those days, this is when I was a very little kid, that was thought of as nothing. You know, that was like he was a neighbor and he wanted you to do it, and you did it because you were afraid of him, because you hoped, you know, that he would help you out.
Do you think your mother looked at the mob figures in your neighborhood as people who could protect your family, or as people who were more likely to harm your family?
No, protect. Because, for instance, the business about the dog being permitted to stay in the apartment, that happened to my family. My mother didn't want to get rid of the dog, so she went to the local guy of respect. I don't even think they thought of them as criminals. There were people who had influence, the way you would go down to your congressman, for instance.
Did she do anything to pay respect to the local organized crime figures who in part controlled the neighborhood?
Well, you have to remember that those figures are usually related by blood, you know, and were members of a family, so you gave them presents. If you had a family member who was powerful, you made sure that you gave him a present at Christmas, you know, or a special occasion, which was not regarded as a payoff in any way. It was, for instance, my parents grew up in Italy, where since they were mostly illiterate, when they had a letter that had to be read, they would go to the local priest to have the priest read it for them, but they would automatically bring a gift. They'd bring three or four eggs or, you know, chicken or something like that. It's a whole different relationship. It wasn't a bribe, it's a mark of respect. It's not like they said, you got to give me a piece of chicken or you got to give me an egg and I'll read it for you. It was just understood. In the same way, the local neighborhood guys that had influence, you gave them presents.
Describe Don Corleone the way you first envisioned him.
He was sort of very much like you had a brother who was much older than you, who would always protect you, you know, who would always stick up for you. He was somebody who was a protector.
I'm wondering if the character of Don Corleone was changed in your mind when Marlon Brando was cast in the film and you saw Marlon Brando inhabit the character.
No, I'm the guy that picked Brando.
You did pick Brando?
Oh, sure. I wrote him a letter, and he called me up, and we had a chat, and then I tried to get Paramount to take him, and they refused. And then when the director came on the picture, I talked to the director, Francis Copeland. He managed to talk Paramount into letting Brando play the role. But it was my idea to cast Brando, which caused me a lot of trouble before it finally got done.
What did you say in your letter to Marlon Brando when you were inviting him to play the part?
I think it was something like, help, they're going to kill me, they're going to cast, I think it was Danny Thomas as the guy.
Danny Thomas? Wow.
Yeah. Well, he was going to buy Paramount so he could play the role. At that time, Paramount wasn't really worth that much, and Danny Thomas was very rich off television. And I read an item, he was going to buy Paramount Pictures so he could play the Godfather. So that scared me so much, I wrote a letter to Brando. I knew some people who knew him, so, you know, I had an entree. And he gave me very good advice. He said, no studio will hire me. Wait until you get a director, and then talk to the director. And he's quite right. When I talked to the studio, they swore they would never hire Brando.
Why were they so opposed to the idea?
Well, because Brando had built up what to them was a terrible reputation of being a troublemaker, you know, on his Mutiny on the Bounty, we cost them a lot of money, and you know, he was always a rebel. So they didn't want him in their movies. He was too much of a headache, and his movies had been flops.
Did he cause any trouble for you on the set?
No, well, I was never on the set, but they tell me it was perfect. You know, every actor just loved the idea of working with Brando. He's their idol, so... And when he came on the picture, he caused no trouble for the director, he caused no trouble for the actors. He was, they really liked him.
Now, what were some of the most difficult parts of adapting the novel into the screenplay?
You mean the first one?
Yeah,
the
novel of The Godfather.
It was a cinch.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it was a cinch because it was the first time I'd ever written a screenplay, so I didn't know what I was doing, you know, and it came out right. And the story I tell is that after I had won two Academy Awards, you know, for the first two Godfathers, I went out and bought a book on screenwriting because I figured I'd better learn, you know, what it's about, because it was sort of off the top of my head. And then the first chapter of the book said, study Godfather 1 as the model of a screenplay. So I was stuck with the book.
I'm wondering, with the dialogue, everything is so, I mean, not everything, but the characters who really have power are very euphemistic in their language. So they could be giving you the message that they're going to kill you unless you follow their orders, but they'll be saying it in the nicest way. And of course, killing would never be mentioned. Everything's kind of beneath, you know, between the lines, beneath the surface. What made you write the dialogue for these powerful, violent people in that coded way?
Well, it does come from the way the Sicilian mafia operated. In fact, there was a funny story that an Englishman came to live in Sicily, and he got a kidnapping note, because they like to collect the money for kidnapping you before they kidnap you, so they didn't have to go to the bother of kidnapping you. That was the way they operated. But the Sicilian mafia wrote this Englishman such a flowery note that he really didn't understand what they were saying. He had to get an interpreter in. He thought they were paying him some sort of compliment. He didn't realize they wanted like $50,000 off him before they kidnapped him, so to save everybody the trouble of going through the kidnapping. But it was very flowery. Your Eminence, we love you, you know, we'll do anything for you. If you have any trouble, give us a call, you know, and meanwhile, just send us $50,000 and you'll never have any trouble with anybody. But that's how they talk. That's where I got it from, you know, that. And that horse's head thing was strictly from Sicilian folklore. They nailed the head of your favorite dog to your door as the first warning if you didn't pay the money. They were great believers in collecting money before doing the job.
One of the most famous lines that you came up with was about making an offer you can't refuse.
Yeah.
Does that line have its roots in mob lore that you knew, or did
I made it up. I wrote memos on how we could plant that line because I was sure it would become a famous line. You know, I recognized the fact it would become one of those lines that people would always be using. So that was really sort of carefully constructed, you know.
Well, when Johnny was first starting out, he was signed to this personal service contract from the big band leader. And as his career got better and better, he wanted to get out of it. Now, Johnny is my father's godson. And my father went to see this band leader. He offered him $10,000 to let Johnny go. But the band leader said no. So the next day, my father went to see him, only this time with Luca Brasi. And within an hour, he signed a release for a certified check of $1,000.
How do you do that?
My father made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
What was that?
Luca Brasi held a gun to his head, and my father assured him that either his brains or his signature would be on the contract. That's a true story.
A scene from The Godfather, with Al Pacino as Michael and Diane Keaton as Kay. We'll hear more of Terry's 1996 interview with Mario Puzo after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Godfather author Mario Puzo. The Godfather Returns, a new novel by Mark Weingartner, is based on the characters created by Puzo.
Did you come up with the expression Godfather?
Yeah. And that was really an accident. Because before I used that, no mafia man ever used the word Godfather in that sense. Nobody used it. And I got it from in Italian family culture, the friend of your parents, when you're a little kid, your parents have very close friends, you call them godfather and godmother, the way in the American culture you call family friends aunt and uncle, even though they're not your aunt and uncle. You know, if they're a close family friend,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you're a kid, you say that's auntie or uncle so-and-so. So that was just the only way in which it was used, except in the religious sense. So I remembered it, and the more I used it during the book, the more it became, you know, what it was. So now the mafia uses it, everybody uses it, you know, and the word didn't exist.
Your novel and the Godfather movies have had such an impact on American popular culture. And I'm wondering what you think it is about the stories that enabled them to have the impact that they had.
Well, I think it's a story with warm personal family feeling. And I think also it's everybody's wish, I mean, that they would have somebody they could go to who would correct all their injustices without the problems of going to court, hiring a lawyer, you know, somebody fixing up your world for you.
And if you cross them, you'd be dead.
But that's okay, because why would you want to cross them if they, you know, did everything for you?
Of course, everybody does end up crossing. I mean, everybody and there's always a bloodbath.
So, people are not perfect.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you become a reader and a writer? You've said that your parents were nearly illiterate.
They were illiterate, yeah. And because of the public libraries and the Settlement House Library, the Hudson Gill Settlement House Library. And you started to read, and it was just the greatest thing in the world to read, that's all.
What did your parents think of you reading? It was something that they couldn't do. Were they proud of you for being able to do it?
No. I wrote a line someplace where my mother regarded my library card with the same horror that present-day mothers look at their son's heroin needles. You know, it was, I made some sort of comparison to that. It was, reading was not relevant. Reading didn't help you make a living, you know?
Wrong.
Yeah, right.
So what did they think you should be doing? What did your mother think you should be doing instead?
Oh, you know, good clerical job on the inside. If you could avoid hard labor, that was the big thing.
Mm-hmm. How have you reacted to criticisms from Italians, for instance, that in American popular culture, Italians are always shown as mob figures, and criticisms from people who say that the Godfather movies were just really violent and, you know, up the amount of violence in American popular culture?
Yeah, well, it sounds like some of my relatives, but but to me, it's a completely irrelevant thing. For one thing, there was a time when Italians ran crime in America, so I'm not maligning them in any way. In fact, I present them as very lovable people, you know, that have to make a living, unfortunately, in a way that society doesn't approve. But also, I know that most Italians that I grew up with were so law-abiding, they, you know, that getting a traffic ticket was terrible, you know? You know, for the working-class Italian people.
Have you always operated very strictly inside the law?
Myself?
Yeah.
Very much so, except in one incident. Because, well, let me see if I can phrase it properly. I would have become a criminal if I had the nerve, but since I didn't have the nerve to be a criminal, I decided to become a writer.
You think you would have become a criminal if you had the nerve?
Sometimes when I'm dealing with movie studios.
Does it bring out your most violent impulses?
Well, yeah, you know, there's sometimes when you want to, you only wish that you could go to a Godfather and say, you know, get these guys out of my shoe, you know?
Well, why? What's an example of something that has made you really angry, made you feel really crossed that a film studio has done?
Well, not on artistic grounds, by the way. I had an unfortunate couple of experiences where I wrote screenplays that were very successful. Not Paramount, by the way. I'm not talking about the Godfather movies, other movies. Where I had to sue to get my money, my percentage of the movie turned out to be very profitable, and I collect the percentage on the back end, and I have to sue to get my back end. And at that time, I was so innocent, I thought that was so outrageous that here I had given them a piece of work that earned them a great deal of money. Why wouldn't they want to give me my share, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd put up legal blocks that you have to fight, and then they surrender in the end, but after they cost you a great deal of money, you know. And also, it's insulting, you know, that you feel you've done a good bit of work, you've earned the money, and then they don't want to pay you. You know, it's so ungrateful. You feel, when you're innocent like that, it's so ungrateful of them. And after a while, you get used to it.
Well, Mario Puzo, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
All right, thank you very much.
Mario Puzo, speaking to Terry Gross in 1996. He died 3 years later. The characters from his most famous work, The Godfather, are explored further in a new book called The Godfather Returns, written by Mark Weingartner. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews two new foreign films, A Very Long Engagement and House of Flying Daggers. This is Fresh Air. Two new foreign language films in limited release, A Very Long Engagement, directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet, and House of Flying Daggers, directed by Zhang Zhamu, have the potential to be big crossover art house hits this season, much like those same directors' last two movies, Amelie and Hero. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
These days, virtuoso stylist filmmakers, real flashy showboaters, are a dime a dozen. But just because you can whir up some Lollapalooza montages on your computer doesn't mean you're a director. Two of the more style-conscious filmmakers who do have an uncanny grasp of the medium are Jean-Pierre Jeunet and Zhang Zhamu. And not only do their names sound weirdly similar for a French and a Chinese guy, they both have new movies about obsessive love in a time of war. Along with much of the world, I was enchanted by the first half hour of Jeunet's Amelie, but that's where the affair ended. 90 more minutes of frisky French gamine whimsy made my tummy ache. When he's on his game, though, Jeunet has a supernatural sense of flow, a flair for camera movement, and an endearing fetish for brown, umbers, ambers, sepias, siennas. His latest brownathon is A Very Long Engagement, based on a terrific World War I novel by Sebastian Japrisot, a mix of sardonic narration and first-person letters, eyewitness accounts of a hellish war from deep inside the fog. The film begins with five French soldiers being marched to the bloody front, convicted of mutilating themselves to get sent home. To make an example of them, someone at the top decides to dump them in the no man's land between the enemy lines. What happens to the men is unclear. Who can know for sure amid the shells, the smoke, the strafing planes, and a subsequent massacre of French troops? More than a year after the war is ended, Matilda, played by Audrey Tautou of Amelie, is sure that one of the five, her fiancé Manek, is out there somewhere. She knows he was driven mad and that he's missing a few digits, but she feels a telepathic connection to him and sets out to track him down. The movie mixes garish horror, sentimental romance, and yes, gamine whimsy in equal proportions, yet makes it all seem of a piece. Characters pick up the thread, relay what they remember, then disappear. One of them is played, in a pleasant surprise, by Jodie Foster, speaking French like a native. Events are shown from different points of view, but not for the sake of some unknowability principle, as in Rashomon. The truth, as they say, is out there, but nearly impossible to dig up from a killing ground already planted over. Jeunet is lyrical even when gliding through vast trenches past mutilated bodies, and it's possible that his touch is too smooth for the level of carnage. But the tension between that technique and what he's showing gives the movie the feel of a macabre fable. It's a mixed blessing, though, that his muse, Audrey Tautou, is such a great camera subject and looks cuter in a hat than anyone alive. The downside to the stylishness is that a very long engagement sometimes seems like Amelie goes to war. In a similar vein, Zhang's House of Flying Daggers is the most intoxicatingly beautiful martial arts movie I've ever seen. And if you think that sounds like damning with faint praise, consider Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Zhang's own hero, and scores of deliriously surreal Hong Kong ghost movies. This one is a sword and dagger extravaganza with some wonderfully florid romantic melodrama. It's set in 859 AD, in an age of corrupt government and a secret rebel sect called the House of Flying Daggers. The plot is too convoluted and too full of surprises to recount here. It involves a blind rebel, played by Zhang Ziyi of Crouching Tiger, and two policemen, played by Takeshi Kaneshiro and Andy Lau. They're ordered to use her to get to the rebel leader. But no one is what he or she seems to be, and a straightforward chase becomes a knotty love triangle with twists and hairpin curves. It would be just an ooh and ah movie, every shot a painting. But the martial arts takes it into another dimension. The fighting blooms out of the emotions, the way song and dances do in musicals. Zhang has a wowza visual concept for each battle. His camera soars behind arrows and flying daggers, which boomerang and bounce off shields and deftly slice people's throats. One sequence will be talked about for years, the battle in the green bamboo forest, the assassins gliding silently down from trees, the fighting on the ground, in branches, on top of shields, in midair. Holy bamboo, Batman! It's so furious, yet so miraculously fluid, and so elegant. Zhang sets the bar so high, I don't know how anyone could top him without redesigning the human body, and even then you'd need his genius for color and composition. Zhang and Junet might be show-offs, but do they have a lot to show?
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Pernick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from TIAA Cref, providing a wide selection of individual retirement solutions, tiaacref.org/radio. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the Jewish mystical tradition known as the Kabbalah with Arthur Green, Dean of the Rabbinical School of Hebrew College and a professor of Jewish thought at Brandeis University. His most recent book is A Guide to the Zohar. Join us for the next Fresh Air.